Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this R&R Live number 3, Digitalization and Cybersecurity, Unhappy Marriage or Essential Partnership, organized with the Paper Jam Club and Arendt and Madonna. I'm Julien Elpy, and together with my colleague Jim Kent from the Paper Jam Club, we'll have the pleasure to moderate this webinar. There is no doubt about it, businesses all over the world are undergoing a digital transformation, one that is being accelerated by the current health emergency, new digital behavioral phenomena, and the use of connected assets. Thus, even as digital practices and applications hold many opportunities for businesses, they also create threat vectors in the financial sector and everywhere else, especially when it comes to cybersecurity. Let me share a few figures with you. 49% of the SMEs do not have anyone in charge of cybersecurity. In France, between 2019 and 2020, the average cost of a cybersecurity attack has grown of 290% for SMEs, while for large companies, it was growing of 27%. In this exclusive podcast, we will deep dive into this topic with our guest speakers, Francis Kass and Astrid Wagner, partner at Arendt & Madonna, and Jean-Marc Huberecken, partner and managing director at Arendt & Madonna, and we also have the pleasure to welcome David Hagen for her participation. Let's start with the first sequence.
So in 2021, the buzzword of digitalization describes not only the process that aims to transform traditional processes, objects and tools, or even professions through digital technologies in order to make them more efficient, but it also evokes a sense of strategic awareness. Now, Jean-Marc, I'm going to bring you in here. From your perspective as CEO, what has this meant and what does this mean for your organization?
Good evening, Jim. There are two types of companies, those who have been hacked and those which will be hacked, as was once mentioned by a former director of the CIA. Nearly 60% of all small and medium-sized businesses that experience a cyber attack are out of business within 6 months. So obviously this is a serious issue for everybody, and it's also a very serious issue for us here at Arendt & Madonna. And in particular, because increasing cybersecurity, at least to a level which I would consider serious, is a long-term issue, and long-term means several years and a lot of investment. Regarding our experience here at Arendt & Madonna, I would quickly mention three aspects. The first aspect is obviously that we hold, as lawyers, very confidential client data, and the clients want us to keep that data very secure. So we have obviously spent a lot of effort and a lot of money on this over the last years. We are basing ourselves on the ISO 27001 standard, and we are implementing our and increasing on a, I would say, a daily basis our security based on that standard. We have also an experienced CISO and a team which is dedicated to the security. The second point I would mention, like to mention quickly, is that we are opening some of our platforms to our clients, starting with litigation clients, and this creates new issues. While user experience for our client is obviously extremely important, otherwise they will not use the platforms, we cannot take any risk with the security of the data which can be accessed by the clients from the outside. So again, there, a lot of effort and a lot of money spent on that particular point. And then we need to be, as a third point I would mention, that we need to be realistic that there is sort of opposition between user friendliness and data security. We are currently here at Arendt rolling out for all our staff what we call a modern workplace platform, which has been accelerated, obviously, by the COVID, like in every company. But it has brought a number of new constraints for our users. One is that we have scrapped a sort of bring your own device policy. And more importantly, we have blocked all personal use of laptop computers. This is not something which makes everybody happy, but it's definitely the safest way to regarding data security.
Right, well, let's just explore this area of risk. You seem to be dividing it into two categories here, governance and technical. Is that right?
The risks are probably essentially technical, but there is a human factor. But the answer is definitely, as you mentioned, governance and technical. Cybersecurity researchers from the University of Oxford have identified a total of 57 different ways in which cyber attacks can have a negative impact on individuals and businesses. Some are obvious, disrupting the daily activities of a company, some which we will talk about more here because we are lawyers, regulatory fines. Reputation is obvious. For individuals, it can be depression. I mean, if some of their most personal data has been stolen or made public, that can be on, as I mentioned, social environments like Facebook or other. But in the case of the Sony hack, which happened a few years ago, it can also be emails they send to their colleagues in their own company, or even information on their paychecks. And we have seen a few months ago a person in a German hospital who died because of a cyber attack. So it can be extremely serious, even threats to human life. COVID lockdowns have increased these risks. One reason is that much more information has gone online, so there's much more information which can be hacked. And the second reason is that companies were forced, and in some jurisdiction even forced by law, and in Germany this has happened now yesterday, to switch to home working. And that means that they have to give access to their employees from outside of the secured part of their own building to their servers. And this is an area which is one of those which is very complex and which needs a lot of preparation. And just switching from one to the other has happened for many companies a year ago, and I fully understand it, and obviously, but it created, from my point of view, a lot of additional new vulnerabilities.
Right, now I'm going to move over to Francis Cass, if I may. Francis, we're streaming this podcast live from your offices here in Kirchberg, so let's bring it back to the financial sector, which we are in the heart of right now. And of course, the sector does, in general, delegate a wide range of operations. What specific sort of risks does that create?
Yes, hello, Jim. And I would say, well, generally speaking, delegation always means adding a new actor in the chain, which helps you to provide a service. And adding a new actor also means adding additional risks. So there can be risks that appear at the level of the delegate itself, or there can be risks in the communication between you and the delegate. And for that purpose, specific processes must be put in place, allowing the financial firm to supervise its delegates. And these processes typically consist in initial and ongoing due diligence, ongoing monitoring of the levels of service received, setting key performance indicators, defining in detail the reporting to be received from the delegate. What is specific in the financial sector is that delegation is used to a very large extent. This can concern delegation of IT services or other services. Many actors are interconnected. Some of them have access to sensitive data, and many of them have staff working from home nowadays. And all of this leads to increased risk. A cyber incident occurring at the level of one actor can have as a result that other actors can themselves no longer perform their own activities. There's also the risk that a hacker manages to get into the systems of one actor and from there, have access to the systems of other actors. Therefore, the financial service providers must be aware that the weakest element in the chain could potentially represent a risk for their own cybersecurity.
Sounds like a very interconnected environment. As you say, we're only as strong as the weakest link. I'm going to move across to the other side of the room. Hello, Astrid. Good evening.
Good evening, Jim.
Now, when we talk about data and the risks related to data management, from your perspective, what kind of data are we talking about?
We are talking about all kind of data, I would say. So data is the new gold, as we all know. So the new digital behavior of consumers, but also of professionals, and the use of connected assets lead to a situation where everyone leaves data out there in the digital world. So that's where we refer to big data. The big data can be collected from publicly shared comments on social networks and websites, voluntarily gathered from personal electronics and apps, through questionnaires, product purchases, and electronic checks. So every one of us leaves their data outside. So as soon as the data includes personal data, companies, obviously, if they use analytics based on big data, need to make sure that they comply with the principles of the GDPR, but also that they really protect this data.
Now, what the average man in the street often thinks about when we talk about data loss is credit cards. And do you think, are we right to be worried about losing our credit card data?
Oh, yes, you are right being worried about that, because your credit card data is not worth a lot on the dark net. So it's very easy to acquire your credit card data. And obviously, there is a huge then risk for you for financial loss. So why do we find those news in the press? Because there is an obligation of information of data controllers who are being hacked, and where there is then an unauthorized access to those data. And since the number of concerned persons is usually so important, that is done by way of the press. So that is what you find in the press. But as I said previously, data is always valuable, and all types of data must be protected. So with respect to personal data, I would like to refer to special categories of data which reveal racial or ethnical origin, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, or trade union memberships. So those data must be particularly protected, of course, because there is a risk of discrimination, or even worse in certain countries, for the relevant persons in case of disclosure of such information. So I would say that it depends on the data, but every type of data has a value for companies. Also, trade secrets and information falling under professional secrecy. So various types of data, they are all valuable and must be protected.
Now, Jean-Marc, what's your view on this point about which actors are most affected by cyber attacks? Is this an issue of risk more for B2B or for B2C?
Both types of companies, whether you cater to business or to consumers, face the same consequences: economic costs, reputational costs, regulatory costs. And there are different types of hackers which are looking for different types of data. I personally believe that B2C companies are more at risk because, as Astrid mentioned, and you actually introduced it, credit card information has a value. It has little value, as Astrid said. It's about $5 per credit card with a CVV code. But if you obviously are able to steal 1 million of those, it's still 5 million. And if you're able to steal 10 million, it starts to become real money. So I think the most important risk for those companies is that something is stolen, which has a value, a quick value, in the sense that it can be sold quickly on the dark web. Those are the types of hackers which are trying to make money quickly. Then there's, for B2B companies, it's much more targeted, from my point of view. So hackers looking at industrial espionage, theft of intellectual property, theft of trade secrets, or disruption of production lines, is something which is targeted at specific companies. It's not just somebody trying to make a quick buck. And then there are two other types of hackers, which are probably even worse. So those which install ransomware, so just encrypting your servers and asking you to pay ransom in order to give you a key to disencrypt them again. And then the last type of hacker I would mention is those who install malware on your servers, which have no other intention of just annoying you. But the problem is that it can still bring your company down, and they're not even looking for money, but I think they're looking for a bit of fun. But it's still a huge issue for the company, because the effects will be exactly the same than all the other types of hackers.
I see. I always wonder who these people are. Francis, can I come back to you, perhaps, with the focus on the funds industry? Are there any specific risks for funds, for example?
Yes, there are indeed some specific risks. And maybe, first of all, to mention also that investment funds, given that there is always important amounts of money, important amounts of assets involved, well, they are by nature an interesting target for a hacker. Also the fact that, as we spoke earlier on about delegation, and investment funds also typically use a lot of delegation. There are always multiple actors involved, like fund managers, advisors, depositaries, administrators. All of them are connected because all of them must have access to some data. And all of these entities use a lot of digitalization. And because of the way investment funds and their service providers are set up, there is always a risk that the communication flow between those various actors is intercepted. Now, in more practical terms, what are actually those risks? Well, on the one hand, and Jean-Marc has already mentioned ransomware, so there's the risk that data or systems are made unavailable. That is one aspect. The other one, maybe also even more specific to funds, would be the risk of fraudulent transactions. For example, somebody pretending to act on behalf of the fund and sending a capital call notice to investors. Or the other way around, somebody pretending to act on behalf of the investor and sending a redemption order to the fund. Then there is also the risk of theft of confidential data, either on investors or on the assets or on portfolio transactions, which are obviously also confidential. So these would be the actual risks. But I would say it's important to manage these risks. And because new risks appear all the time, and hackers constantly invent new ways of attacking the industry, it's obviously impossible to completely eliminate the risks. But in particular for the investment fund industry, it's important to use appropriate efforts to limit these risks as far as possible.
I see. And we're going to come on to some of the remedies a little bit later. But Astrid, I'd like to come to you now and talk a little bit more about Luxembourg and about what about the legislation and the measures that have been put in place here.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. So our legislation obviously is comes from or stems from European initiatives, and so there is a harmonization throughout Europe. But what I would like to state here is the Luxembourg's position on cybersecurity. So cybersecurity is a requirement from a data protection perspective, but also from a regulatory perspective in relation to credit institutions, professionals of the financial sector, but also to investment fund managers. And cybersecurity expertise is necessary to enhance trust and foster stability of our digital infrastructure and services. So following a 15-year effort, and I say really 15-year effort, Luxembourg already enjoys strong recognition far beyond national borders in the field of cybersecurity. Security Made in .lu has launched the concept of the cybersecurity ecosystem 4 years ago. And a mapping was done of the Luxembourg cybersecurity ecosystem to feature the local cybersecurity community, providing users a central and easy access to all relevant actors and initiatives of the Luxembourg cybersecurity ecosystem. So you would be surprised to hear that we have in Luxembourg over 300 companies which are active in the cybersecurity sector. In November 2020, last year, Luxembourg submitted its offer to host the EU Cybersecurity Competence Center based on many very good sales arguments. And among those, we have the fact that Luxembourg is hosting several European Commission units in the digital area and the Euro HPC joint undertaking. Luxembourg also boasts a dynamic and open cybersecurity ecosystem, as comes out of this the mapping which has been done by securitymadein.lu. It offers a state-of-the-art high-performance and secure IT infrastructure, and also high-performing telecommunications and data storage networks are guaranteed, as Luxembourg offers one of the highest density of tier 4 certified data centers in Europe and acts as an ultra low latency hub. So unfortunately, Luxembourg failed in its bid against Bucharest in Romania, but our cybersecurity expertise in Luxembourg is really a factor of attractiveness for businesses in a time where cybersecurity is so important.
Thank you for that. So it sounds like Luxembourg is doing quite a lot, but Francis, from your perspective, do you think this issue is really attracting sufficient attention by the authorities?
Yes, I think it does. It clearly has very high attention of the regulators in different angles. And so on the one hand, when you have regulated financial service providers, when they apply for their license to get authorized, they must demonstrate that they have a solid and strong and robust IT infrastructure in place. It's in particular the case for banks or investment firms, managers. And this infrastructure will also obviously have to be updated and kept up to speed on an ongoing basis. In addition to that, there are also more specific IT-related topics that regulations are focusing on. Just to give a few examples, we have regulation on compilation of management board or strategic documents. We have regulation on cloud computing, rules on external computer attacks. And there was also recently, in April last year, quite an interesting CSF circular on financial crime, in particular in the COVID context. So I would say there is a lot of regulation in place. Certainly it has a very high attention from regulators. But I would also add that in this constantly changing environment, it's important to adapt constantly to these new risks and to be proactive and even to go beyond existing regulations. So for example, when mentioning early on about the investment fund area, where the service providers, they are very well used to being subject to these specific rules on IT infrastructure, investment funds are much less so, which is normal because the funds themselves don't have that infrastructure. But nevertheless, in case of an incident, the board of the fund might be held liable for the damage caused due to an incident. And that's why it's very important for the board of a fund to be aware of the risk that the fund is exposed to. It must itself ask the right questions, and it must be confident that it has taken adequate security measures at the level of its service providers in order to protect the best interest of the fund and its investors.
Thank you very much for that, Francis. It's now over to my colleague, Julian.
This is not a legal advice.
Thank you very much, Jim, and thanks to our speaker for this first part. Welcome to this This Is Not a Legal Advice insert. After each part, we'll have a little conclusion like this. For those of you listening to Arendt We Live for the first time, this is a short moment to step aside and ask our speakers to step out of their legal roles. Yes, sometimes, you know, we want to hear what you think for real, you know, not just the legal advice. And to open this sequence, honoring the ladies, it is Astrid Wagner who is going to start. Sorry, Astrid, we had to start with someone. Astrid, I'm talking to the person and not to the lawyer. How do you manage your personal use of data, devices? How do you do with passwords on a daily basis? Do you have a little angel lawyer on your shoulder saying, don't do that, and a little devil on the other shoulder saying, do it?
So just to clarify, I did not, so Julien did not share the question with me in advance.
Absolutely, huh? It's not prepared.
And I have to say that it is very difficult to manage that as a data protection lawyer, but also a tech lawyer. Because you obviously want to take benefit of all the new applications and all the online services which are offered to you. But on the other hand, as I said before, we all leave our data outside in the net, in the digital world. And so I try to be careful and to always look into the settings. Sometimes I try to read privacy notices, but I wonder whether the data protection authorities also read them, because I always have a lot of comments and questions. I mean, we have to live with it.
Thank you very much for your honest answer.
This is not a legal advice.
And to go further with this podcast, for this next sequence, we'll welcome David Hagen for an interview together with Astrid Wagner.
David Hagen, you have been working for 20 years at the CSSF as head of IT supervision of regulated entities and support professionals of the financial sector. Last May, you launched your own activity consisting in strategic advice in ICT and cybersecurity for the financial sector. You provide services around regulatory compliance review, advice on the implementation of cybersecurity strategies, review of cybersecurity governance, security policies, and operational aspects. You are also honorary president of the association CLUSIL, which means Club de la Sécurité de l'Information Luxembourg, after having been its chairman for 10 years. You are actively involved in the country's cybersecurity initiatives, and you are a lecturer at the University of Luxembourg in the Master in Information Security Management. David Hagen, thank you very much for having accepted our invitation, and thank you for sharing your impressive and well-recognized experience with us today.
Thank you very much.
It is a fact that nowadays outsourcing is becoming more and more common among financial institutions. In your experience, what are the points of attention to be observed in terms of information security for information that will be transmitted or accessed by the service provider?
Well, first of all, the information must be considered as a whole and not just in terms of data protection as covered by the GDPR. Often the GDPR perspective is the first to be considered because this European regulation has been widely covered in the media. In the context of a financial sector regulation, data security goes beyond personal data. As a result of this assimilation of data security to GDPR, we are increasingly seeing the DPO, the data protection officer, taking on the role of the ISO, what we call the information security officer. However, these two functions should be separated since the data to be protected are more extensive than personal data. It covers also know-how and other confidential data held and processed by companies, which must also be protected. As you know, in the computerized financial world, the data have become the assets or the new gold. So if compromising the data means compromising the assets.
So protecting data is key. But how can information security then be addressed?
There are fundamental elements of data to be considered and represent the golden rules to be followed. The CIA, so it's very easy to remember. Confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Compromising any one of these elements renders the value of the information worthless. In the financial sector, in addition to the CIA, it's often the practice to add the element of evidence, the proof, to demonstrate that the three criteria are not compromised, but we will not address this point here. Thus, in fact, the risk associated with the loss of confidentiality, integrity, and availability of data are those that must be measured, controlled, reduced, or even transferred. Transfer means who can be insured, but needless to say that not all risk can be insured. All financial sector authorities, whether national or European, aim to ensure that adequate measures are in place to keep this risk under control. This is particularly the case for the European Banking Authority, the EBA, guidelines on ICT and security risk management, and the CSSF Circular 20750, which requires the implementation for a large number of licensed financial institutions.
In that respect, can you please tell us what should be the scope of the due diligence process to be followed by financial institutions with regard to data security?
Well, if the secure service provider is a regulated one, as it's the case for Luxembourg Support PFS, the due diligence process may possibly be lighter as they must comply with the same regulation, and in particular with the requirements of the EBA, since the CSSF has extended these requirements beyond banks and payment institutions. This is unique for the country. But for other service providers, even if they belong to the group of the Luxembourg financial institution, for example, the parent company, it's important to ask which documentation related to security is available. This may be SOC 2 Part 2 reports, ISO 27001, type certification, etc. But it's imperative to carefully review this documentation in order to verify the coverage of the study. If the documentation is deemed insufficient, the financial institution can provide its own questionnaire, but careful in the case to check whether the answers are documented and not based on declaration only.
Mm. What would be your recommendations in relation to establishing such a questionnaire?
But such a questionnaire can be based on the requirements of the CSSF Circular 2750, and thus which are the EBA guidelines, and at least one of the chapter information security. The circular contains an excellent catalogue of principles which the provider should apply. In all cases, it's mandatory to contractually foresee the possibility for both the financial institution and the regulator to audit the service provider, which leaves the ultimate possibility of verifying on-site the accuracy of the answers provided. Well, it's also possible to check whether the service provider has a regular intrusion test carried out by the independent third party, particularly when its systems are connected to the internet. In this case, however, it's also necessary to ask for the results and the corrective measures taken in response to the failure observed. Finally, simply providing contractually that the service provider undertakes to ensure data security does not in any way prejudice the consequences in the event of damage, because the risk of loss of reputation may be greater than any financial liability the provider can ensure.
But how far should the protective measures implemented by the service provider go?
Understanding the technical mechanism implemented by the service provider to secure the data is important, but it's not sufficient. Information security depends on multiple factors that are not purely technical. For example, staff training in cybersecurity is essential, since nowadays the majority of attacks succeed because of the weakness of one link in the security chain, which is the individual. The individual is often unwittingly manipulated into clicking on a link. So this link will allow the hacker to install a backdoor into the system or to corrupt it. Who hasn't been contacted by email to renew their Lux Trust or other certificate while it's still valid? Or contacted by email because for a plausible pseudo-financial transaction, such as Amazon, for example, to be verified. All means are good for hackers to get targets to click on their link. But furthermore, IT and security risk management must be structured according to a methodology that allows both the evaluation of the measures implemented and the continuous improvement of this management. This is why the circular and the EBA guidelines clearly state that the CISO, the Chief Information Security Officer, should be on the second line of defense and must remain independent of the operational function of IT. The CISO cannot depend on the Chief Information Officer, CIO, because of obvious conflict of interest. Unfortunately, this is still a trend observed in the field. A number of CISO are hierarchically placed in IT under the CIO. But by observing the service provider organization, the financial institution will be able to assess whether or not the service provider is applying good practice. An ISO placed under a CIO will reveal a lack of understanding on the part of the service provider of the information security measures to be applied. In short, it's not only the technology that guarantees information security. For example, it's not enough for the service provider or the financial institution to encrypt data to protect it. They will be protected with regard to confidentiality and most probably integrity, but not necessarily against unavailability. Ransomware that encrypts data with a hacker's key makes the data unavailable even if it's protected. So the ransom is claimed to restore the availability.
Yes, right. And then maybe as an end note, is there another point of attention to be observed when carrying out due diligence on the supplier?
In this period of COVID crisis, a majority of actors have switched to teleworking. If you outsource activities and therefore data, do not hesitate to ask your supplier about the security measures surrounding teleworking, and in particular whether his employees can use their personal laptop or whether they have to use the one provided to them. A personal laptop can be compromised for a long time without the employees knowing it. So needless to say, of course, that the communication will also be protected by cryptography like SSL, TLS or any other means.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you for having shared those insights with us.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Well, thank you very much, David, again, and thank you, Astrid, for this interview. Let's move on to the second part of this podcast, the need to protect oneself from the new risk linked to the digitalization.
So we're now talking about the strategic dimension of cybersecurity. Does one strategy fit all? Probably not. Jean-Marc, I'd like you to put your CEO hat on for a moment and just ask you, has this issue prompted you to create any new roles at management level?
We have, in fact, indeed, yes. we have two different positions, two different roles. One is the CISO and the other one is the DPO. So the Chief Information Security Officer and the Data Protection Officer. David Hagen mentioned already both and giving a bit of introduction on why they are different. The Chief Information Security Officer is responsible for the organization's overall information and data security. And the overall aspect is important because it's not just data, it includes all the systems, the servers, the access to the servers, and so on. And he also needs to make sure that the appropriate systems and processes are in place to reduce cyber threats. He further needs to make sure what the cyber threats are out there, that everything is patched, that there are no vulnerabilities, and so on. And so the background of the CISO is very often, if not almost always, an IT background. The role of the DPO is actually very different, and that's why it's a very interesting and important question. The DPO is a role required by GDPR, whereas the CISO, your company can have one or not. It wouldn't be good governance to not to have one, but it's not a legal requirement, unless that actually might be the case for regulated companies where we live. My colleagues to answer. But DPO is a legal requirement, at least if you're a company which has personal data, which I think most companies should have. And so the role of the DPO is to monitor compliance with the GDPR rules and all other data protection rules, including internal data protection policies. And so the role of the DPO can be extremely strict, limited to personal data, but I think it would also be good governance to have a wider role, and he can sort of audit measures which have been put into place by the CISO.
Now, may I just generally challenge you on that? I think one person could do both of those jobs. Is now you've had these people in place, are you really convinced they bring value having two different roles?
The DPO is generally has a legal background, so it's a person looking at compliance with regulations and laws, whereas, as I said earlier, the CISO is actually an IT expert. But there are other reasons for having two roles. The most important reason is probably that they may conflict. The CISO wants to ensure the security of the data, and that might mean keeping the data over a very long time and all types of data, whereas the role of the DPO is not only to ensure the security, but also to ensure that it gets that personal data gets deleted after a certain time and it doesn't stay on all the servers. So there can be issues, and I think this is a very important one, where there's actually a conflict of what one needs to put into place and what the other needs to ensure that doesn't happen. There are also a bit more philosophical questions on who, towards whom each of them actually has a sort of fiduciary duty. So the DPO, does he have a fiduciary duty to to the persons who are the subjects of this personal data, so the clients of a company, for example, or also to the company, and whereas the CISO obviously has a fiduciary duty to the company. Opinions differ on that, but at the end of the day, I'm not sure it's an extremely important difference, because we know what the roles of each of them are, and they are quite different.
No, thank you. Absolutely. Francis, I'd like to just broaden this conversation for a moment and talk about boards in general. Have you seen a change in response to cybersecurity?
Yes, and I would say in particular there has been a change in attitude of boards, so that they can no longer remain purely passive, just hoping that no incident will occur. I think we already said it previously, in today's world, where large institutions, they are facing at least smaller incidents or attacks all the time. So that therefore it is the role of the board to make sure that the firm is prepared and that it has a response plan readily available in case of an incident. I would also say that the board must give the right impulse, which will then have to be implemented by the rest of the firm. The board will have to decide which are the strategies, policies and procedures to be put in place to limit the likelihood of an incident to occur, so that's before something happens. But then also, after an incident has happened, the company must be prepared and have an action plan ready to determine the steps that have to be taken in that event. All the people in the organization must know what they have to do, and they must know that in advance so that they are able to remedy the situation very rapidly. The relevant systems and action plans must also be tested on a regular basis. And I would say, well, there's a growing number of institutions for which cybersecurity is becoming a standard item on the agenda of the board of directors. So there is definitely a change in attitude of boards as well.
Right, I see. Now, wherever there is cause, there must be consequence. Astrid, we've heard a little bit about the data loss, but in terms of consequences, can they stretch beyond financial loss?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Jim. So I would like to make here a difference between the consequences on the individuals whose data would be accessed in an unauthorized way, and on the other hand, the consequences on the companies who would be the victim of a cyber attack. So for the relevant individuals, the consequences could be financial loss, could be damage of to their reputation, could be discrimination, as mentioned previously, but also identity theft. So if there is an access to ID cards, utility bills, so that is everything which is in the KYC file, that is obviously very dangerous, because you can, a person could, for example, take up loans in the name of that person, and you would end up with having several loans to repay, but it was not you having contracted with the bank. So that is obviously very, very heavy in terms of consequences for those individuals. With respect to the company, which has been the victim of an attack, whereby attackers have had access to data, there are obviously the direct and indirect financial losses. So next to fines which might be imposed by data protection authorities, there could also be a loss of confidentiality of trade secrets and IP, which would lead to a loss of a competitive advantage. A loss of availability of data, for example, processed by a hospital, Jean-Marc mentioned it before, could even lead to death, and unfortunately that was also the case already in the past. And then the loss of availability of the production line, so disruption of the production lines of a factory, would also then have indirect financial consequences. Let's not forget the civil claims, which could come from the individuals whose data had been accessed, in case there was a fault, an error having led to such a damage. And then, last but not least, and Francis said before, that is probably the consequence which is lasts quite long, which is the reputational damage. So that shall not be underestimated. And obviously, with the publication of fines, and in certain instances, there is this obligation to inform the impacted individuals. So that may lead to important reputational damages.
So, Francis, from your perspective, are you telling me that it's actually necessary to protect everything?
No, I would not say so, because it's just not possible to protect everything. I think we said early on, there are changing risks all the time, and so it's rather a question of managing the risk. So it's all part of what I would call risk management. And therefore, well, one must assess which are the main risks to which a company is exposed. That includes identifying which are the most precious data of an entity, which are the most vital systems, so which are the systems which it absolutely needs to deliver its most important service to the client. So this is an assessment that the board of the company must do, and then concentrate its efforts on protecting such most valuable data and the most vital systems. I think that should be really a question of what is the right focus, rather than protecting everything, which anyway is not possible. And then perhaps also on the methodology, I would say, and just to repeat what David Hagen has also mentioned early on, the question of there are two questions, what to protect and how to protect. And then the question how to protect, of course, those measures will depend on the goal, on the type of data. And what he mentioned, for example, was to say, well, it may be necessary to encrypt certain data, such as confidential client data, but this will not protect you in case of a ransomware making your systems unavailable. So there is also, it's a choice of data and it's a choice of methodology.
Now, Astrid, it sounds like this is all sort of inevitable, that this risk is going to be present, but how can we mitigate that?
I think that you can mitigate the risk by being just better protected than your neighbor next door. So first of all, a company should start with the awareness raising of its staff, so training the staff, starting at the board level, then to the C-level, and later on to the employees. So I said before, the human error human factor is a weak link in the chain. And so also the CNPD reminded that in their annual report of last year, saying that the human error is really the first cause of data breaches. And that it is key and very important on a regular basis also proceed to that awareness raising and training of the staff. And then obviously you need to go through, make an assessment of the security maturity and the risk of the IT systems, then remediate to those where there are gaps, need to do live threat monitoring, and of course prepare an emergency response. So putting a business continuity and disaster recovery plan in place, that is super important to be able to react very quickly. So there you could mitigate the risks, not really of that a cyber incident would occur, but when it occurs that you can reduce the damages resulting therefrom. And then obviously you need to put in place information security policies and procedures. And then another element in mitigating the risk is a cybersecurity insurance. For obvious reasons, because you have an insurance against those risks, but also before contracting the insurance, the insurance company will want to do a due diligence on your IT systems and on the maturity of your systems. And so that can also already be a first step to make the IT systems more secure and to take then later on the necessary actions.
Now, it's interesting you talk about due diligence, because I was going to come back to Francis and ask you, in a financial perspective, for example, when a service provider is selected, from a due diligence oversight, what role does cybersecurity have here?
Yes, I would say it's an increasing role. Let's say due diligence is, of course, a concept that exists already since a long time, so making sure that you choose the right entity, that the entity that your delegate has the necessary capabilities to deliver the service, that they are reputable, and so on and so on. And as part of all of that, cybersecurity also plays an increasing role. This is because investment firms must be aware that if there is an incident happening at the level of the delegate, this will almost necessarily have also an impact on their own provision of service. And that's why it's necessary to control the potential risk that exists at the level of the delegate. And that this is where due diligence must be put in place before appointing the delegate. But then one would usually also expect to have an ongoing due diligence, which is done so to update the procedures, let's say, every few years. But then, in addition to that, one would also typically contractually agree on some other measures or reporting or information flow to be provided by the delegate to the financial firm. So that's, for example, reporting on any type of incidents that may occur at the level of the delegate. It's, of course, providing more detailed information on any incidents that may also have a direct impact on the client. But then going further, you can also foresee contractually that your delegate must be, again, operational within a certain period of time after an incident has happened. Or one can also foresee that you even impose certain sanctions or indemnification clauses in case the delegate does not comply with its obligation. So it's certainly an increasing part that cybersecurity plays also in that respect.
Now, I know we don't have too much time now, but Astrid, is there a certain methodology about making these sort of assessments?
Yes, there is. And to make it very brief, so I would refer to what David Hagen told us in the interview. And I would say what is valid for regulated entities can also be applied by non-regulated entities. So requesting documentation around cybersecurity, what is in place, where does the company stand? And then if that is not sufficient, then a questionnaire can be submitted to the service provider. And but you obviously need to make sure that the answers are confirmed by documented procedures and processes. And then you can also carry out an interview with the service provider's chief information security officer, if he has one, on the security measures and or maybe certifications in place.
So Jean-Marc, actually, I'm going to bring you in here. Back to one of your favorite words, I believe, governance. Is it true that you consider that cybersecurity is now an integral part of governance?
Francis talked a bit about this, about governance and how boards have to act on this. I think we need to be realistic. Many board members want to be focused on cybersecurity, but they don't feel completely at ease on this topic, quite a bit mystified even. Many don't have an IT background, if not all of them on most boards. And so they might not have sufficient knowledge or confidence to talk about it, but I believe this is actually okay, as long as the board understands what the role is in cybersecurity. And the role is not passive. I think that Francie mentioned that very accurately. So they can't just sit there and wait to receive reports by the CISO, but they need to help set the organization's security strategy. What does this mean in practice? It's they need to be responsible for. They don't need to be. So let's start with that. They are not responsible for choosing the right security tools or architecture. That's why they have experts on that, but they are responsible for identifying what needs to be defended and how important that is. That's something Francie mentioned also. We really need to define what is important for the company, what systems need to be operational at any time, and what information or what systems could be viewed as less important and could be out for a bit of time.
Francis, do you agree with that?
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. I would say that cybersecurity is becoming more and more an integral part of governance. Some actors are already very advanced, others are maybe a bit less so, but still to come. I would maybe also add that while putting in place all of these measures, all of these procedures, policies, and so on, obviously, in the first step, this will be considered as a burden. It's necessarily an expense, so it's not something very, very funny. But nevertheless, I think what, as always, what is a requirement, what is a burden, can also be seen as an opportunity. So those actors who are very advanced, who have done more than just the minimum to protect their data, to protect their systems and the client information, well, they can use that as a sales argument to differentiate themselves from their competitors.
Now, I'm just going to finish this section with one final question back to you, Jean-Marc, because we've talked a lot about the responsibility of the company and the board, but what hope is there when there are people like me who still use 1234 as a password? Do you think employees share the burden of security?
Yeah, they should. I think Astrid mentioned that employees are typically your greatest source of vulnerability. And why is this? I mean, we all know that we are not happy, the employees are not happy with almost any restriction implemented on them. They're not happy with web filtering restrictions. They are not happy when their social media is blocked on the company's computers. We are not happy when we cannot use the corporate laptops for personal use. And why are we not happy? Because then we have to carry two computers when we travel. And as you mentioned very correctly, we hate passwords and we particularly hate to change them. But I think the very least, and I think most companies should at least try to reach this threshold, is that employees should know what they should not do, not click on stuff which they are not comfortable about. But more importantly, they should know what to do when they have done something which they should not have done. Well, to put this a bit more easy to understand, I mean, Kaspersky, they have noted that 40% of employees hide a security incident when it happens and when they are responsible. So employees should at the very least have the responsibility or the good sense to immediately contact their help desk or their security people once they feel that they have clicked on something which they should have avoided doing.
Jean-Marc, very good advice. Julian, over to you.
This is not a legal advice.
In fact, this is not a legal advice, and for the second timing, I'm going to turn myself to Francis Cass. I'm going to ask you, Francis, to put yourself in the shoes of a board administrator to answer a cybersecurity quiz. So it's a pop quiz. It's easy questions. One question, three possible answers. There's no 50-50 or call to a friend, so you have to answer directly. As a board member, what is the first thing you should do if the company is facing ransomware demands? A, determine with the boards if ransomware demand is legitimate and follow the instruction to get your data back. B, call Francis Cass. C, contact the police and do not pay the ransom.
Well, maybe the answer is a bit biased, but I would choose answer B.
Well, please stick to A, B or C. Thanks. if you were to do a phone phishing, who would you target in the company? The CFO, a secretary, or a board member yourself?
Good question. Why not a board member, yes?
Ah, great. Then you need an advice, and I know someone who can help you. You see, as a board member, actually, you have the managing director sending you an email to tell you that your attendance fee has just been multiplied by 4. You only have to click the link in the mail and follow the instruction giving bank information. A, you jump of joy and send it straight back. B, you take a subcontractor to evaluate if the application is correct. C, you throw the mail away directly.
I jump of joy, but then maybe before clicking, I will ask my IT specialist if I should do so.
Well, well done. It's 3 good answers. Thank you very much, Francis.
Thank you.
This is not a legal advice.
And it's now time to head to the third and last part of this podcast. What to do when it's too late, because we all understood that it's going to happen.
So, Francis, we're not going to let you rest for long, because I'm going to crack straight on with this part here about, are all cyber attacks the same in terms of action or consequence?
Yeah, no, I would say very clearly they have very different types of attacks and incidents. And I would say also as a result of that, the consequences and the actions that need to be taken are also very different from one attack to another. I would say if there is, for example, if there has been a data breach or leak, one needs to assess, well, which data was concerned? How valuable was the data? Is it internal data or external or client data? Does the company need to notify its clients or business partners, potentially report to authorities? So there is already a difference depending on the data. If the systems are made unavailable there, of course, it's also the question, well, how essential are those systems? If there have been fraudulent transactions, it's the question, well, does it affect one of our clients? Do we need to indemnify our clients or not? So there can really be, even within those categories of data, systems, transactions, even within those categories, that there will be very big differences from one case to another. And I would also say that some attacks can have short-term consequences. You remedy the situation and then everything is fine. Other can have very long-term consequences. And I would say, generally speaking, the reputational damage tends to have very long-term consequences.
Now, I'm going to come across to Jean-Marc now, because I've heard it described that at a company level, it's important to react quickly and well. What does that mean?
Call your lawyer. But once you've called your lawyer, I think it also depends when you do that. Very seriously, my understanding is that also from partners with whom we work together on this IT crisis, that most people try to work on cyber attacks which have happened for a few days, and then on Friday evening they start to panic, and then they start to call the lawyer, the insurance, or the IT experts. And Friday evenings is not a great time to get people involved and to bring them to your office. And I mean this very seriously. As Francie mentioned, you need to contain the break, to assess the break, so you need IT experts, you need forensic experts immediately. And then you need to manage the fallout. And that's obviously where the lawyers come in, but it's also immediately, because you don't have a lot of time to inform the regulators. And you don't even know at that stage, if you don't have a cyber incident response plan, which regulator we are talking about. And when I mean that, I mean in what jurisdiction, which is very much dependent on what kind of data has been breached. You need a crisis communication expert. So there are quite a number of different people you need to involve. And if I may make a 30-second advertisement for Aaron, I would like to say that we have actually been working on this for a number of months now, and we have set up a team of all those different expertises, some of which are in-house, obviously, at Aaron, and some are not in-house, like the IT experts and forensic experts on these crisis modes. And we have a full offer, let's say, in case one of our clients is the victim of a cyber attack.
Right, Francis, I'm going to turn back to you. And I already know that part of the answer is Francis Cass is part of the answer. But the question is, what and who should be warned when a breach has occurred?
Yes, and so that depends, again, on a case-by-case basis. It depends on the contractual obligations that the company may have to inform with its clients or business partners. Again, if the entity is regulated, it must be reported to the authorities. So it's really not the same for all type of actors, and it's probably within one actor also not the same depending from one incident to the other. So all of that, the priorities, the sequence of information must be determined by the entity in that action plan. But I would also say, so this plan will then define everything that must be done. I would also add that, well, ideally, somehow there should also be guidance on what should not be done. For example, having uncontrolled communication by the staff on the incident, on social media or wherever. So again, this element of training of staff, raising awareness of the staff on how to react, what to do, but also what not to do in case of an incident, that is very important.
Now, Astrid, do you agree with that? Is there a specific order or priority list that companies should implement after a breach?
Yes, Jim, I would like to, I see that from a data protection angle, where data protection authorities want to know very quickly what exactly happened, how many individuals are concerned, which data has been leaked, and so on. So for me, it is a first priority to understand what happened. Obviously, before that, the cybersecurity incident has to be stopped. Systems have to be protected. But so that is very important to understand what happened. And then also, companies need to be prepared in advance in order to be able to immediately call a panel of specialists and to have meetings organized and to be able to do that 24/7. That is very important. Also, not destroying important evidence. So that is again a question of raising awareness. So what shall not be done. So that is very important. And then, who needs to be informed? What is the order of priority? So first of all, certain competent authorities, relevant authorities. And then if there is a risk to the rights and the freedoms of data subjects, you might need to inform. So in that case, you need to inform the individuals, which is something a company would ideally like to avoid. But here it is important to manage that with a communication expert. So there are ways of saying things. And with the help of a communication expert, that can be done maybe in a more elegant way. But I would nonetheless recommend clients in the case where there is really a risk to the rights and the freedoms of their clients, for example, to do that as soon as possible, because clients also lose confidence in the company if that is not done on time. And then there is also an obligation to react very quickly for processors. So if a company contracts with another company which is acting as a processor, then that company has to immediately inform, in the case a data breach occurs, immediately inform the data controller. So there is not even this 72 hours for which you can wait. So if there is a subcontracting down the chain, it must companies must ensure that process will work on the day where there is a data breach at the level below, and information has to be upstreamed very, very quickly.
Right, so you referred that to both subcontractors and clients and individuals. Mm-hmm. All of those people potentially need to be updated. Perhaps could I just move back to Francis and talk about the board liability, therefore? Does the board have a liability to act in a certain way?
Yes, well, the board can be liable for this, like for any other actions or inactions. Let's say, based on starting perhaps with liability under corporate law. So I would say that the board is not automatically liable in case of any incident that happens, even if the incident causes a loss. But the board will be liable if it has not taken all reasonable measures that a normally prudent or diligent board member would have taken in the same circumstances to protect the company against cyber attacks or before or after events. So it will be assessed on a case-by-case basis, was the board diligent or not, and it can also be liable for inactions. What I would add as well is that to be able to prove whether it was diligent or not, it's as always very important to document what has been decided on what basis, which measures have been taken, and why, so that if something happens, that they can explain later on, maybe if it's a few years later, they don't remember by heart what has happened, but they will be able to document why certain decisions have been taken at the time.
Right, and finally, in this part three, Astrid, sanctions. Can sanctions be applied by the regulator?
Oh, yes. As we all know, the GDPR provides for huge administrative fines. And here I would just like to mention that it is interesting to see that out of that 2 out of the 10 biggest fines which have been imposed by data protection authorities in 2020, so last year, are due to insufficient IT security measures in place and having allowed cybersecurity attacks, cyber attacks to, so to speak, be successful.
Right, fantastic. Gosh, Astrid, thanks so much for that answer. And now, in fact, I'm going to pass back to my colleague, Julian.
This is not a legal advice.
Yes, this is not a legal advice, part three, with Jean-Marc Huberken. Last but not least, I'd say. We've seen together that digitalization comes with its share of opportunities, but also of threat. So for this last one, this is not a legal advice of the evening. I propose you a questionnaire where you can only answer whether it's a threat, an opportunity, or both. And just be quick. It's 5 quick questions. Let's say the latest CRM, including marketing automation, is it a threat, an opportunity, or both?
Depends on your point of view.
This is called cheating.
No, I will. It's a lawyer's answer. We have to say both.
Okay. Alexa. A voice, an artificial intelligence voice of assistant.
Again, both. I think many people don't use it because they feel it is a threat.
Clearly. An automatized email system. This is almost a Francisca's question.
Automatized anti-money laundering. I think that would be an opportunity.
Great. The brand new Arendt Insight app.
Oh, that's definitely an opportunity. There's absolutely no threat there.
And the last one is a lawyer question, actually. Is Doctrine a threat, opportunity, or both? Doctrine.fr.
Oh, that's a tricky question. It's it's a very tricky question because
you can have a joker.
No, fine. Something you probably ignore is that the case law, which is in the doctrine system, was stolen from the Conseil d'État in France. Hmm. So it's there's criminal litigation on this. So against doctrine. So it's actually a huge data breach because the entire French case law was actually stolen on the servers of the Conseil d'État.
That's cheating, but that was very interesting. Thank you very much for your honesty and for our education.
This is not a legal advice.
So as a final wrap-up to this podcast, I'm going to whiz around our speakers to get one key takeaway from each of you. Francis Cass.
Yeah, so for me, the key takeaway would be the awareness of investment fund boards for the topic of cybersecurity. If I take myself also as an occasional fund board member, let's say, well, usually what one is confident in relying on the systems and measures that are in place at the level of the different service providers, but one does not necessarily always realize that being it oneself at the board of a fund, well, you are also supposed to do certain things, and that you are you become aware of the risks that you are supposed to control. So that for me, this awareness rising of the consciousness of investment fund boards for the topic of cybersecurity.
Fantastic. That's about 3 takeaways, but I'll let you off, Francis. Astrid, what's your takeaway?
If the question is not if, but when a company will become affected by a cyber attack, then my takeaway is that all companies need to be ready for the day when it occurs.
Perfect. And Jean-Marc, to conclude.
To conclude, I would say that not every company needs to have a digital security strategy, but there cannot be any strategy without including digital security.
Well, thank you all very much. Thank you to all the three speakers and Jim for moderating this Aren't We Live podcast. We'll see again soon with the podcast. The date will be announced soon enough. So thank you very much to everyone and have a wonderful evening.